Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
The New Statesman.
Hello, I'm Anoush.
And I'm Armando.
In this episode of Westminster Reimagined, we'll be joined by May Dobbs, political campaigner and digital strategist, and James Ball, investigative journalist and author of Post-Truth, How Bullshit Conquered the World. Both have tracked the rise of post-truth and misinformation and can give us an insight into the effect it's having on our politics. We ask if the UK is now fully in a post-truth world and how we can counter it. Now, Armando, I was looking this up. I thought the term post-truth politics was first applied to Britain during the EU referendum campaign when we had all of those sort of souped up promises from the Leave camp. But actually, it was in the run-up to the Scottish independence referendum, yeah, which I do remember as quite nasty. I remember Nick Robinson, who was then BBC political editor, had to hire a bodyguard, and you had a lot of accusations of lies on both sides.
I remember that's the start of a very worrying trend we're seeing in politics in the UK, which is when a journalist asks a particularly pointed question at a politician, that politician's supporters just boo and harass the journalist. Mm. And that's not something I ever expected to see in Britain. We claim to be the mother of all democracies. I don't think we are. and providers and protectors
of father
above priestly. So yes, so that so your mistake about the your belief that it was actually to do with the referendum on Brexit is actually a post hoc post truth assumption, because it did start earlier. And from memory, I think it was one of those things that Donald Trump used against his enemies once he was criticised for doing it himself. Because I think initially the idea, the label post-truth or fake news actually was put as to him, and then he used that phrase to turn it against his enemies. So now anything his enemies say, fake news. And we're now, depending on when this podcast goes out and whether we have a functioning democracy at the time of listening or not, or indeed a functioning prime minister at the time of listening, we're now in the situation where if anyone criticises anything about economic policy, we're part of the anti-growth coalition, which doesn't exist as an organization. I'm sure a few of them have registered it now, just to prove a point. And again, it's this build-up of the idea of something you believe being as valid as something that is factually true. That if you think something is happening, that's just as right as that thing actually happening. And therefore, there is no need for evidence,
yes,
to back up your assumption and your belief.
Yes, and anyone countering you is doing it in bad faith and lying.
Yes,
and
exactly.
They're the woke brigade or the metropolitan elite or some other sort of nebulous blob, like you say, that doesn't really exist.
Yes, and so my concern now is, have we reached that point where that, you know, that singularity where we can't go back, that mainstream media, to give it that terrible phrase, has now been so undermined that actually we can't believe anything that we read and see and hear. And then now what do we do? So strap yourselves in for a very bleak half hour.
And before we get to our guests on this episode, we spoke to the former BBC Chief Creative Officer, Pat Young. Pat spoke at the Edinburgh International TV Festival recently about how the BBC is under threat from a post-truth, post-evidence government. And we asked him what he meant by that and what it can do about it.
What I meant by that is that we find ourselves in a situation where we are providing evidence to support the positions that we take. And we're dealing with the government that runs a consultation exercise, for example, on Channel 4. 96% of the responses are against privatising Channel 4. And the government says, well, despite that, we still think we'll go ahead and privatise Channel 4. There is no reference to the evidence. I think the problem for us, I mean, we're British, so we play by the rules. And so I guess us liberals, we say, well, we'll take part in the process and we'll engage. And they're tearing up the rule book left, right and centre. So what I was trying to say at Edinburgh was we've got to do more than this. We can't rely on the evidence speaking for itself because these people are ignoring the evidence. And the evidence is inconvenient. We live in a system, we have a set of broadcasting regulations, which put a lot of power in very few hands, and we relied hitherto on this British sense of fair play. And I think what we've seen with the current government is that no longer applies. I mean, they're taking a lot of their cues from what's happened in America, undermine the media, undermine people's trust in the BBC and other news sources, and then it's just opinion. And as we've heard in the Brexit debate, it's just one opinion amongst many.
But what can public service broadcasters do other than play fair? In the moment they try and be more, I don't know, aggressive or unfair, obviously, you know, that's going to come in for a lot of criticism. They're kind of hampered in what they're able to do.
They are and they aren't. I mean, I think Emily Maitlis caught this well at Edinburgh, where she said basically, you know, in a mask, he said, get your balls back. One man saying that the earth is flat, and science saying the earth is round, you don't have to give equal time to the man that says the earth is flat. Give him time in proportion to the validity of his opinion. And if it's opinion, you just call it an opinion. I think, you know, we have to ask ourselves, why was Nigel Farage the most frequent guest on Question Time? There was this fear that if we don't satisfy that community, that agenda, we're going to be criticised. Well, in proportion to all the other elected representatives in the country, he had massive overrepresentation.
Yes.
And so they've got to get their balls back. They've got to sort of, they know what impartiality is. Yeah, we study it hard. They need to believe in it and execute it.
In this part of this wider discussion on post-truth, what can the BBC and ITV and Channel 4, you know, our kind of free-to-air networks do to kind of counter the threat to evidence-based reporting?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. So first of all, I think the government does have to legislate on this rather technical sounding issue called due prominence, which means that the public service broadcasters, which includes ITV, Channel 4, Channel 5, have to be given due prominence on any platform. So whether you access services via Amazon or any of these other aggregators, you have to be able to find them very quickly. And why is that important? Because I think with our overall news regulatory environment, it means the mass of people will get access to unbiased news information and comment, which will allow them to take decisions and engage in an informed democracy. And you only have to look at America, where most news consumption is via proprietary channels on cable, where MSNBC take the left-wing position and CNN until recently took sort of the center-left position and Fox take the hard-right position. Which is why 70% of Republicans who will watch Fox News believe the election was stolen, that Obama was born in Africa. There is a reason we don't have that here. And that's because to date, the prominence of our PSBs. And so we need to make sure that due prominence continues into the new environment. So that is something that the new Secretary of State has to address quickly, because it's the ecosystem, it's the environment. Mark Thompson used to call it a digital public space, which we can all engage in and get trusted information. And the internet and these big tech platforms have changed that space. And we need to sort of get some regulation that provides people with trusted news and comment.
Now, I'm so pleased that we're joined by two very special guests, two activists who've been at the coalface of our post-truth world. May Dobbs is a political consultant who's worked on 6 national level elections across the globe, including working with the Labour Party in the UK, working on Anas Sawa's Scottish Labour leadership campaign, and on both Barack Obama and Joe Biden's presidential bids in the US. She's seen how social media was used by all extremes in the US elections and specialises in countering online misinformation that can infect our democratic processes.
And James Ball is an investigative journalist and reporter. At WikiLeaks, he was closely involved in Cablegate, the release of 250,000 classified US embassy cables. And at The Guardian, he worked on the coverage of the NSA leaks by Edward Snowden. He's also written a book, Post-Truth, How Bullshit Conquered the World. Welcome both. I painted a bleak picture. Am I just scratching the surface?
Yeah, I wrote Post-Truth in 2017 and everything's got a lot worse since then. So I think it's got like this because we let it. It's got like this because we were complacent. And I think part of it is we think fake news and post-truth happens to other people. As we get polarized, as we get angry, it happens to us. There is plenty of madness and misinformation on the left, and there is plenty in the center. Mm-hmm. And it's almost more dangerous in the center because centrists, in my experience, are very convinced that they're the sensible, measured ones, while coming out often with lunacy.
Oh, go on. And so,
is that the government crashed the pound on purpose?
Yeah,
is that
sort of stuff like it's a hedge fund conspiracy or Tufton Street control. People, there's a lot of red string. Or to be honest, there was some massive nefarious plot to vote Brexit rather than sometimes people vote differently to how you want. And I think what's sort of getting deeper is each of us engages with this sort of mad conspiratorial world where everyone who disagrees with us is either being duped or is evil. And so no one's talking to each other anymore. Everyone's shouting incoherently.
We've built up this our own kind of conspiracy that there is this world of post-truth that people are purposely...
That the post-truth world is Russia's fault or is X's fault. It's part of our circumstances. It's that we're poorer than we were, we're alienated, we're... But actually, we frame the discussion of post-truth as if it's someone evil or malign behind it, which it's entrenches the problem.
Mm-hmm. But in America, it is someone evil, isn't it? Or is that...
It's Joe Biden.
Yeah, of course. He's part of the cabal. I actually think there's something nefarious behind all of this stuff happening. And it's not any one politician on one side or the other, but it's the social platforms that we all get our information from. I have seen this starting from 2007 when I worked on my first ever political campaign as a student organizer. We were using Facebook as this like lovely ideal of what social media should be, connecting people and organizing and getting people to come to rallies and knock on doors. And that was great. And then in 2020, when I worked on my most recent presidential campaign, it was an absolute horror show, nightmare. And that didn't just happen because people got worse in the past 15 years. It happened because the social platforms are literally built that way. They want people to be angry. They want people to be upset because they spend longer online when they are. When they're upset, they engage. Engage is a nice way of saying it. They argue, they get into fights online, and then they spend hours and hours. And because of that, Facebook and the like can sell more adverts. They make more money. And so maybe that sounds like a bit of a conspiracy, but Facebook have said it. They basically said the longer people spend online, the more money we make. And the more angry people are, the longer they spend online. And it just makes it worse and worse. So I think there is a bit of a nefarious force behind it. And it's the platforms we use to get the information which are causing all the problems.
The incentives suck for everyone, though. Yes. CNN rated way better under Trump than it is under Biden. There is money in courting the controversy while looking respectable. There's a lot in it for politicians. They can crest this kind of populism for quite easy victories, even for quite mediocre or actively bad politicians. And so you've got this world where actually political incentives and financial incentives are much more on the side of the nonsense.
And you're right when you say we're part of the problem. I caught myself just the other day nearly getting sucked into it when the only social media I use is Twitter. And which doesn't excuse me.
The angriest network.
It doesn't excuse me in the slightest. And somebody tweeted, did I hear Therese Coffey on the Today programme saying poor people is not as poor as they think? And I was all set to retweet this when I thought, no, hang on. Did she say that? Yeah. And it turns out she didn't say it. But by then, you could see there was a whole chain of retweeting that almost it became established fact that by the end of the day, many people believe that's what she said.
I wrote Post-Truth. I present a podcast about conspiracy theories. And last week, I basically started a conspiracy theory.
Deliberately? So, or?
No. Yeah. Liz Truss gave her conference speech and she was wearing a quite distinctive dress. Declan Cashin, a guy I used to work with, noticed that it was what Emma Thompson wore in the Russell T Davies drama Years and Years. And because of the way my mind works, I immediately recognised the wood panelling and realised that it was from a scene where it's quite a chilling scene. She quite jovially presents to investors setting up UK concentration camps. Mm. I went, oh, wow, coincidences happen, but it's not just the populist dress. It's from where she's literally setting up concentration camps. Yikes. And sort of realised I didn't want to set people off too much. Immediately replied to my own tweet going, for the record, I absolutely do not think this was deliberate. And of course, the first tweet has a couple of thousand likes, retweets, etc. Yeah. And loads of them are people going, mad liberal conspiracy nonsense, brain worms. And the second tweet's got about 20 retweets. And it's, I literally tried. I was a fool.
But given that we're all fools, how far are politicians prepared to push it? You've been at the European election campaigns in the States.
Yeah, they are willing to push it as far as they have to win. Unfortunately, I'm working right now on the midterm elections in the US and working against one candidate who said that he was in the military, touted it, not just, oh, by the way, I was in the military. It was part of his platform. And of course, it came out that he wasn't in the
military.
And
he's saying it's classified now, is he?
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Now it's, oh, well, we can't know if I was actually there because it's all classified. But if it was classified, it would just say classified, not missing information. And then so on our side of the camp, we're trying to just tell people, hey, this guy is lying. You should know that, so you shouldn't maybe vote for him or consider it. And then, of course, in all the comment sections, it's just, no, you are lying because he actually was. And, like, why are you trying to stop our great veterans from talking about it? But the other side knows that they can get away with it because they see the same comments that we're seeing. Mm. And so they just keep going and going and going. And there's no consequences.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you. Yeah. How do you counter it? Because clearly you've had some success in some of the political campaigns that you've worked on in this kind of environment.
Yeah.
Did millions of fake ballots help?
Yeah, those were instrumental.
Oh, God, that's going to get clipped, isn't it? I've done it again.
Stop it. Yeah. Left and right starting conspiracy theories. Yeah, it's tough. It's really tough. And one of the other things that has happened in the age of social media campaigning is that things happen so quickly, like your accidental conspiracy theory. It could have been 1 minute later, and all of a sudden now everyone has seen it. The retweets have happened. And so what we were seeing a lot on the Biden campaign was Donald Trump would tweet something inane, wrong, not true. And an hour later, I was seeing it in the comment section on Joe Biden's Facebook feed. And how do you counteract that? How do you intercept something that happens at the speed of light? And so what we tried to do on the campaign was set up Joe Biden's character and make people understand him as a person to say, no, I don't think he's a pedophile, for instance, because I understand Joe Biden as a good person and a family man. We tried to hammer home on just him as a person and these like kind of personal truths about him rather than counteracting every single conspiracy theory.
Yes, because if you mention the conspiracy, even to rebut it, you're mentioning it again.
Exactly.
It helped that Biden's quite an authentic character. I mean, you know, I covered him in the 2012 race and all the things that people put down to dementia, except he gets names wrong. He flubs all the time. He's done that. But it means that it's hard to imagine there being a front or, you know, is part of it this sense
yes,
that
that's normal. You're not looking at a master criminal.
Yeah,
when
you
you're
can't
looking at
fake a certain kind of authenticity. And the downsides of that are the gaffes, but the upsides are people don't go, I think there's some secret second thing behind
it. Yeah, and I think that's what Trump supporters like about him as well. He seems very authentic. I don't think he has a filter on his mouth. He will say anything that pops into his mind. So I think, yeah, that's the kind of 21st century voter just wants that authenticity because then they feel like they can trust them. And they trust so few things in the world now. They don't trust the media. They don't trust their government. But if they feel like that person is authentic, they can trust them. I think that's why both Biden and Trump were so successful.
Well, it's emotive politics, isn't it? People aren't really necessarily interested in the policies unless they chime with what they believe, but they're not asking for, can we see the financial workings out behind the policies? Can we see how you would implement the policies? Mm-hmm. It's just like, what do you believe? If you believe the same as I believe, then I'll vote for you.
They don't have manifestos in the US. It's nuts. Like, they, yeah, it's so weird. Here, I'm not about to go UK politics are sane and reasonable because look at UK politics. But, you know, a UK election campaign, you'll have like health policy day, education policy day, sort of stuff like, and they still roll out like that. America is stump speech, and it's the same speech said 500 times over 3 months. It's really odd.
Hi, Anoush here. We've got a special offer for Westminster Reimagined listeners. You can subscribe to The New Statesman for just £1 a week for 12 weeks. Just go to newstatesman.com/podcast offer. And you can check out all our podcasts, including audio long reads and world review at newstatesman.com/podcasts. We'll be right back.
From The New Statesman comes World Review, a twice-weekly international news podcast. From Ukraine to Brazil, DC to China, we cover the stories that matter in a world that's constantly changing. Every Monday, we interview a guest for their unique perspective and expertise. And then later in the week, we come together to unpack some of the most significant stories in world affairs. Join us. Just search World Review wherever you get your podcasts.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at hellofresh.com.
But here we are in a climate, and one of our other podcasts will be looking at whether British politics has become too presidential, because here we are in the middle of various leadership challenges and crises. Mm-hmm. When we have someone who's not elected on the basis of a manifesto, but on a very small electorate of Tory members, implementing policies that everyone thinks is wrong.
Well, is she implementing them? You've got the expert here.
By the time this goes out, that may well have changed. Yeah. But we're at a situation where we're, in the UK, I think, where we're joining this new tradition of implementing politics by emotion. The leadership campaign was conducted via Instagram, really. It was all shots of people looking prime ministerial, mm-hmm. really, on a tank and in front of children and mm-hmm. by a hospital, rather than saying...
What's she doing with a tank in front of children? That's weird, Amanda.
There's another conspiracy.
Yeah, no, I really think I've had this discussion with a lot of politicians in the UK in the work I've done, and I say, oh, we did this in the Biden campaign or whatever, and say, oh, why don't we try this? It worked really well. And they always say, oh, no, that wouldn't work here. Exactly what you were saying. It's a lot less based on emotion. And I disagree.
Yeah.
Fully. It's not.
I think that's true because a lot of what people say now is Britain is ready for a boring prime minister, and that's in order to try and paint Keir Starmer's sort of limited presentational skills in a positive light.
Captain Charisma himself.
Yeah. And I can see the intellectual argument behind that, but I just don't think it's true because humans are humans and our gut feeling is to be attracted to charisma. And he's trying to lean into this sort of boring dad image of himself, and maybe some of the authenticity of what we were talking about might come through and appeal to people. But the idea of just being boring in itself, I just don't think that works here, just as it doesn't work in the US. Is that something that you found with the people
yes,
you've spoken to?
Definitely, yeah. For sure. And I think because everything happens on social media these days. Mm-hmm. Social media, they are all platforms for authenticity. You are meant to show your true self. That is why they were invented. And it's very similar, I think, in looking back in the 1960s, the very classic Nixon versus JFK presidential debate, the first televised debate, and you look at JFK and he's very suave and charismatic, mm-hmm. and that works well for television. Whereas on social media now, the very blunt delivery of a Donald Trump works really well on Twitter. And I think we're seeing that same development over time where from the 1960s to the 1990s, charisma and polished was great for television. That's what people wanted. Now, people want authenticity in real stories and like real voices.
Yeah, because now slickness is being slick is an insult, isn't it? Yeah.
And yet it's amazing how often people do it. I sort of, when the polls were far less good for Labour, I spoke to a pollster and he said that as he saw it, the issue with Keir Starmer was he felt like someone who would focus group whether to piss standing up or sitting down, just totally trying to message and shape and be who is expected to. And maybe because there is so much polarization and fake news and whatever, people want someone who they think can't lie to them. Not even necessarily won't. I think we've hit a cynicism where no one really trusts anyone. But if you get the impression someone runs off their mouth or someone just doesn't really have a filter, that's a substitute for trust. Whereas polish, people just really, it doesn't work at the moment. And yet everyone still tries it.
Yeah.
It's these sort of, you know, I'm the adult, I'm the sensible one. And it's all, we've reeled from crisis to crisis to crisis.
So is that
working for us? Is
that a kind of glimmer of hope then that actually somehow we've achieved a kind of herd immunity against lies and that we're now beginning to have the strength to determine whether someone is speaking truth or not?
I think we need to shift authority to authenticity. It used to be the newsreader was from Southeast England, six social classes above me, had a nice accent, and would tell you all the news because it's that. And the Bieber's actually slowly caught on that everyone hates that and doesn't trust it. And as they do things like newscasts, yes, you actually got to see a bit of personality from, yes, sort of Koonsberg and Chris Mason, etc. And you realise, oh, they are human. They do make jokes like the rest of us. And I think that connects with people. It was really interesting what you were saying about the TV era. Mm. We are in a social media era and people want stuff to seem real. And I do think it's harder to fake.
Yeah. But where's the way back from in American politics where, you know, you can say, you know, from day one, I had the biggest inauguration crowd of any president ever when the photographs show you clearly didn't. Mm-hmm. To, there was no insurrection on January the 6th. It was just people being boisterous.
Or Antifa. I haven't decided which one.
In the early days of the pandemic, it's not a pandemic. Yeah. It'll go away. Mm-hmm. Don't you worry.
Yeah.
Very soon, America may well be governed, but in the White House and in the House and in the Senate, mm-hmm, by a party who propagates that. What's going to happen if that's the case when they have a kind of stranglehold on truth and lies?
Yeah, unfortunately, it's not going to be great. I don't have an optimistic take on that. My feeling is the only thing that's going to pull us back from this is starting to regulate the social platforms, which currently no regulation at all. They can do whatever they want. And as we've talked about, their incentives are to sow discord so that people fight each other and stay on the platform all day and all night. And so because of that, I mean, on the 2020 campaign, we were allowed, we didn't on the Biden campaign, but we were allowed to put anything on our ads. They were not regulated. If someone said this is patently false, Facebook would say, well, it's free speech, which is absolutely ridiculous because an ad that is put on television, that's regulated. If it's patently false, it has to be taken down. But on social media, they just keep hiding behind the free speech thing. And so I think we're not going to really change that until we can actually get some regulations in place.
But how do you regulate them if the legislature is governed by people who don't want to?
Yes, that's the problem. And they see a lot of actual personal incentives as well. You know, the Facebooks of the world and Google, they get a lot of incentives for getting Republicans in power because they get tax cuts. They make so much money if the Republicans are in power. They love it. And there's less regulation because the Republicans don't want to regulate. So it ends up becoming they're all in bed with each other and we're screwed.
I did promise this would be a blow. Yeah.
But how much, okay, this is an obvious question, but how much was it ever thus? You know, I can think of falsehoods that everyone accepts, yes, in Britain. For example, Labour crashed the economy in 2008. You still hear that when you go around door knocking with politicians. People will repeat that, yes, back to you.
It's the 1930s.
Tony Blair shouldn't have gone around selling all those mortgages in Tennessee.
Exactly.
In the 30s, the Mail had, the Zinoviev letters or something, just a false letter saying,
yes,
that.
Several of the founding fathers, yes, spread fake newspapers, yeah, in the UK that actually led to atrocities in America. They wanted Britain to pay reparations for the war on independence. And so they said that Brits had bribed Native Americans to do raids and kill, like, people in American villages and commit these massacres. Now, these newspapers were fake editions, only circulated in Britain. But obviously, some of them got back to America, and then there were retaliatory massacres. Mm-hmm. And this was Ben Franklin. So there has been some atrocious things people,
yes, the disposition to do that was always there, but is it, yes, that the means now to do it is just so easy and so
and it's so fast.
Universal
so fast.
And fast.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Because I was on the Obama campaign in 2007. I would go knock on doors and people would say, I won't vote for him because he was born in Kenya. The classics. But that was, we definitely felt it was moving a lot slower. It was being talked about and probably on, you know, right-wing radio, people were talking about it and that could move pretty quickly. But the way it was being spread mostly was through email chains, if we all hearken back to the day of the email chain, forwarded on to five people. And so that was moving through kind of social circles in a very organic way and at a much slower pace. So we felt on that campaign we were able to counteract it and say to people, no, this isn't true for X, Y, and Z reason. And eventually he did win and he showed his birth certificate and it's horrible, but we were able to counteract that. But yeah, now I think the speed at which these things can happen, it's impossible. We can't say.
I should say I don't agree it's technology. I think we will always point to a faster technology and see it propagating there and say that's the issue. I think there are issues with it. I'm not. I would be an idiot if I said otherwise. But the social contract is breaking down. It's not working. Work doesn't pay. You can be in professions and you can't get a house. We haven't had a pay rise as collectively as a nation since 2007. People are doing everything right and not getting the living standards of their parents at their age. And it's not just people on the breadline or people in the working class. It's the professional classes as well. And it's not just young people now. It's people in their 40s. And when the social order is breaking down and the social contract's breaking down, people get angry and polarised and open to populist messages.
Which goes back to your earlier point that it's us. It's not the social media. It's us. There is a reason people vote for extreme politicians or are drawn towards extreme groups.
If society starts meeting the bargain, if the social contract's upheld, people are less prone to the person shouting the bad thing. You're open to it when you're going, well, hang on, why isn't this working? I'm doing everything right and I'm not getting it. That's where you start looking for the explanation and that's where it's the Jews, it's QAnon, it's whatever. That's where you're susceptible to that.
But I will say, it's not even people are looking for it. That's the problem with technology. But I agree, it's not just technology. If Facebook had never been invented in the Harvard dorms, we would not be in a perfect utopia. But it's making it worse because people aren't even necessarily looking for it. They just log on and they say, oh, that's a cute dog. And then all of a sudden QAnon is in their feed. And how did that happen?
Yeah.
There was this really interesting study done where they just set up a fake Facebook account for some woman called Carol in North Carolina. And she was just, you know, a slightly conservative mother. And they just started clicking on stuff just randomly as someone might. And within 5 days, she was in QAnon groups. Because that is the algorithm that is trying to force people to this extremism. So yeah, I totally agree. It's not just technology, but it's not that people have to even go looking for it. They might be a bit upset in their lives and be upset about the social order breaking down, as I agree. But then it just appears in front of their faces. I think that's the big difference, is they're not even going, I don't even know what you do, go to a chapter of a communist party meeting back in the day or whatever. But now you can literally just sit in your home and it appears. You get inundated without even knowing you're being
invaded. On the upside though, we are going to have legs in virtual reality in 2023. So, you know, who's to say?
Pros and cons.
One thing I was thinking, part of the reason we're doing these podcasts is that we're interested in the idea of getting people from not just the standard political voices, but those involved in campaigning and politics and the issues that are dominating the news today, to have a discussion. And that idea of bringing people together, not looking for an argument, but actually trying to exchange views. And it may be that we have to go back into schools and universities and encourage people to actually at least encounter people who have different views from their own. Because otherwise we end up in the situation where we're at today, where it's either Tory scum or the anti-growth alliance, and there's nothing in the middle. People are being labelled as hostile if they have a different opinion from your own.
So the danger of pointing it to schools is, I mean, firstly, you're giving up on anyone over the age of 10, which is quite a long time for everything to go wrong still. But also, you've got an overextended education system and you're relying on a generalist teacher with maybe hour a week for one term a year.
Where are the opportunities to do something like that then?
Generally, actually, I think the difficulty is often, and I speak as someone who works in the mainstream media, we want to keep doing what we've always done. And we just want the public to enjoy it. Alternative voices grow up when the mainstream doesn't connect with people and doesn't talk to it. It's not that these are fighting. They're the sort of dodgy news sites and the extreme news sites are a symptom, not the disease. But actually, the media needs to go where people are. Politicians need to go where people are. And instead, what we're trying to do is stand on this sort of hill that's rapidly eroding away and go, why aren't you still here with us? And so it's the humility to go. I think there is a habit for those of us at The Guardian or The New York Times or whatever to go, we're going to keep doing what we've always done, which is right and good. And why isn't it, you silly person? It's a bit like the Remain argument that every Brexiteer was tricked. It's actually, no, they weren't. And you're a dick for saying it. Sorry. And you're a prat for saying it.
Dick is acceptable.
Yeah. I'm very glad.
What about your solutions, May?
My solution? Yeah. So my number one, as I've said, is regulation. We just... It is just absolutely wild that these are the biggest media companies in the world and there's just almost no regulation. So they won't solve every problem, but they will help. Either just breaking them up. They're huge monopolies that just everyone gets their information from and they can do whatever they want. So even just breaking them up would be helpful. And having some types of rules about what can be said, especially on the advertisement side. Again, it's on television, so why can't we do it for politicians who are running for office? Why are they allowed to go on Facebook and say outright lies and not have any kind of consequences? So that's one side. But then as a campaigner, I definitely agree with what you're saying. Like, we need to be better at meeting people where they are and not just putting an op-ed in the New York Times. That's not super effective. But I work on campaigns and they still think that's the end-all be-all. Right. We got an op-ed in the New York Times. change hearts and minds, but it's not going to. So being more authentic, as we've talked about, being in the places where people are, coming to them on their level and talking about things they care about. There's so many things where you're trying to shove something down someone's throat and it's like they don't care about that. We need to be effective in figuring out what people actually care about and addressing those needs and helping them, as you've been saying, making the social order come back together. And then just personal things that we can all do is don't retweet stuff. Don't respond to things.
Yep.
If you have to, take a screenshot and then post a brand new post, because we are just feeding the algorithm this horrible mess of things that shows that the worst types of behaviors are rewarded. So point, that's something we can do.
Point very taken.
Something we can all do every day. Right. Don't engage.
Good. Don't engage. That's the message.
Switch this podcast off.
After you've listened to this, burn it. That's no. Well, after let's end on those positive points and those positive suggestions. Thank you very much. I'm sure we could talk about this for hours.
Oh, happily.
Thanks so much, both of you.
Great. Thank you.
Really interesting. They actually didn't agree with each other on everything, did they, about the sort of technology's role in our instinct to believe?
No, they didn't, but they did agree that fundamentally we're doomed, I think. I can't shake myself out of this deep despair about this whole business, because how we reprogram ourselves to look more analytically at stuff and not to be, like, I gave the example of myself, so being caught up in a fake news cycle. It's becoming second nature. It's something we don't even think about now. It's just part of our automatic responses to join in. Where there's a crowd yelling or screaming or laughing, we go and join in. And it's very difficult. I mean, I think what came across was whatever we do to try and stop it, like deregulate or regulating the social media, these are small steps that are very hard to achieve unless you have the political world behind you.
Yeah.
And that is the problem.
Yeah. And when you said join in, I think it's something that we did touch on, but we didn't go into it in that much depth. But there is a need for belonging and a need to have an identity, isn't there, among people?
That's right. Yes.
And that's probably because of part of what James was saying about the social contract breaking down. We feel more isolated. We don't feel like we're getting back what we deserve from society. Although it seems quite a grim solution that the only way to fix this is to fix the social contract.
Well, yes. Yes, that's a big fix.
Yeah.
It's a big ask.
Yeah, and it's not always the right government in power to do that.
No, and it's a long-term thing. It's not something that could be done overnight or even in the next 5 to 10 years. And I do also wonder whether the fact that we are a bit more fragmented in that we do spend more time by ourselves on our screens, strangely, it adds to that impulse to then try and search for something else that connects us with to other people. And if it's on our screens, we're finding these other people all massed in one group, having a go at someone or cancelling someone or shouting at someone or just sharing a dog meme, then we want to go and join it, really, for a bit of company. Right, so Anoush, what's on the agenda next week?
Well, on the next episode, we take a look at the B word, Brexit, with two brothers on both sides of the debate to see if they can find anything to agree on.
You've been listening to Westminster Reimagined on the New Statesman podcast with me, Anoush Shakelian, and our special guest host, Armando Iannucci. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review and don't forget to subscribe. You can watch video from this podcast on the New Statesman's YouTube channel and on the New Statesman website. This episode was produced by Adrian Bradley and May Robson. Our executive producer is Chris Stone.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.